Whether you're here just for the talk or the day or the sesshin. Every one of us is essential, I think. It's pretty amazing that we would do something like this, don't you think? And of course we want to know what we're doing. We want to know how all this works. How do you do it right? And it seems like our Soto Zen ancestors aren't given a whole lot away in this department. Seems like they're not so much encouraging us to think about how to do this, but more like how to be this. Or maybe the how is already a little too much. Maybe they're encouraging us just to be. Just to embody, inhabit, you know. But then the mind wants like a subject on that sentence. Inhabit what? Be what? Do what? So sometimes we'll throw in a word we don't understand, like Buddha, just so we have something on the end of that sentence. Be Buddha. What's this mean? I think it's gradually dawning on us over the years and decades that even though we at first thought this was a very practical practice to calm down and feel better, it's not really. It seems to be a little more about trust and faith than we at first could have imagined. And the early Buddhisms, lately I've been using this plural, Buddhisms. It seems like there's not just one Buddhism, but lots of Buddhisms, maybe as many Buddhisms as there are Buddhists, and of course, scholars or certain kinds of curmudgeons could point out, well, the Buddha didn't say, I'm a Buddhist, you know? What does that even mean, Buddhist? Practitioners of something that seems to have had a continuous connection over the millennia. Buddhists, we'll say for now. Anyway, it seems like early Buddhism, maybe there's a little more emphasis on step by step. These practices help with suffering. And that you should figure it out yourself, see what works. At least that's what you hear, and you hear this phrase, quote, a quotation of the Buddha, be a light unto yourself. Have you heard that? Turns out he never said that. So maybe some of what we heard or understood about Buddhism was like American individualistic culture, you know, sort of picking and choosing a little bit. There are early Buddhist texts in which he encourages practitioners not to just blindly sort of follow along with the dominant ideology or the latest teacher in town. But those same texts also call for quite a bit of patient practice and faith in those who are wise. Somehow you're going to know who's wise. And I don't think the early students of the Buddha sat around under the tree after a talk and said to themselves, well, I like that thing that he said. That one, I don't know, not so much. I'll just do that one. I think they were really faithful to their best, in the best way they could be, to what he taught and how he was. And that the evaluation doesn't happen in this system over like a few hours or a few days or a few years, but more like deeply inhabit this way of practice for a few lifetimes and see how it's going. And then to simplify, it might be that the later Buddhisms of Mahayana and Soto Zen went even a little further, saying, well, don't even try to figure out what's wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. Forget about trying to come up with tools or techniques or ways to improve. That's the whole problem, that you're thinking that way. Stop all this churning and effort making and figuring out and trying to do it right or wrong, and just sit down. Just sit down and let all this noise and angst and agitation like slough off. Dogens, we've been talking a lot about Dogen this year. I'll talk a little bit about Dogen and then talk about one of Dogen's ancestors this morning. So Dogen's famous teaching is that through patient, steady practice, sooner or later, our layers and layers and layers, you know, of tension and fear and doubt and me, just like fall away. I was thinking it's a little bit like, as we roll into winter here, I mean, it's a little bit like when there's a bunch of snow on the roof. And then it starts to warm up a little bit. Still pretty cold. Starts to warm up. And all of a sudden, that layer of snow up on the roof that's like pretty heavy, you know, pretty dense, big thing. Enough of it can break buildings, you know. But sooner or later, apparently all of a sudden, the snow just sloughs off, you know. Wow. It seems very sudden, but of course it's been gradually melting all along. To me, it's like that. I thought of a new metaphor. And most of these teachings are given in poems and metaphors. In our chant book, about half of what we have in there is poetry. We dutifully chant it and try to figure out what it means. This morning we chanted a poem by Master Shurdo from, I think, the 8th century. The Merging of Difference and Unity is the title we have for it. And we have poems in our chant book from a little bit later ancestor, Master Dungshan. And this retreat, we thought we'd explore some poetry and teachings from another Chinese Zen luminary, Master Hongzhi, who was somebody that Dogen really appreciated a lot. Dogen, scholars have picked Dogen apart pretty well and done like word counts and analyses, and now it's all electronic so they can do this stuff. And the teacher that Dogen in his voluminous writings mentions the most is his teacher, Ru Jing. And then the second place finisher is the fellow we're going to talk about, this Sashin, Master Hongzhi. And let me make the necessary apology for the patriarchal nature of this line of thinking. These are all the men that the men put in the org chart, you know. And it seems very likely that these characters all were people who existed, as it seems likely for Shakyamuni Buddha himself. Our first and most important Zen ancestor, though, Bodhidharma, is like the most dubious whether he was an actual person. One of the scholars of Buddhism that we really like, John McRae, says, lineage assertions are as strong as they are wrong. Lineage assertions are as strong as they are wrong. In other words, lineage is a central part of the Zen mythology. And if you make a really big deal about somebody, it might be they didn't exist, you know? Like Bodhidharma. Maybe he existed. Some people think he did. I don't know. And does it matter? Yes and no. So as we learn about these ancestors and their stories, and we also at times bring up the stories of the woman ancestors who got left out of the records but, you know, are being rediscovered. On the one hand, I think it is worth thinking about and studying and finding out what we can. about what was historically true as best we can tell. That's pretty hard to tell. Do we really know? And of course, there's entire fields of history that have ways of determining so or not so. But I was thinking about a time when I was about six. I think I was about six. And my brother and I must have been five. My sister wasn't there yet. My brother and I are on a ferry somewhere. I don't even know where. I made up in my head it was in Maine, but I don't even know if I've been to Maine. And my brother was carrying this rock. Like a kind of rock. I don't know if it was precious to him or if he just had a rock for some stupid reason. And we're on, like, you know, like there's like the kind of up above, you know, the cars are down below, like where they go off and you can be up above looking out. And my brother drops this rock and breaks a windshield. I'm sure this happened. I remember this happening. But my mom doesn't remember this happening, and she would have been the one who had to deal with it, you know. So did it happen? I really don't know. So history is questionable already, right? You know? And the more, every time I think about it and tell it, the more real it is in my mind. I can watch the rock falling and the cracks and the, you know. Although, no, actually windshields don't crack, do they? They just shatter, so there's some counter evidence. So on the one hand, it's good to be curious of what's historically true and a little doubtful of the possibility of history. On the second hand, I have a kind of a three truths proposition for us for all these kinds of teachings. The first is historical. And it's what's great, we live in a great age for this, the blossoming of contemporary, readable Buddhist scholarship. You can, even as a non-specialist, some of it you get a little lost, but most of it you can make sense of. So we can learn more about the history than ever was available to any Buddhist ever, you know. It's amazing. The second thing is what I call devotional truth. Definitely that happened, you know. My brother, I'm sure, learned something important from it. Definitely these characters lived and breathed and did the things that the stories said they did. And we can be inspired and amazed and impressed and buoyed up by their devotion to practice, their wisdom, and their teachings. And how they got through really hard times, you know? And we can too. And thirdly, we can put these two strands together, the historic truth and the devotional truth, and wonder about the practical truth. How can I myself practice with this? What can I learn from this? And that's not always too obvious either, so I think it's a continuous sort of process of investigation as we encounter teachings. What really happened? Yes, it really happened. How can I practice with it? So back to our enterprise here, inspired by these luminaries who gave us nothing much but poems. Dogen did give us some practical instructions. We chant two or three of his texts in our chant book. One of them is a meditation manual which says very specifically how to sit down, how to hold your legs, how to do it. And we can learn that. But then we have this very difficult mind, and he gives us but a couple of words only on the mind. Once you've arranged your body, he says in there, turn towards your thinking. In fact, why don't you practice no thinking? How do you do no thinking? Oh, that's easy, he says, non-thinking. You're like, what? So maybe our tradition is designed to frustrate us a little bit if we try to do it, if we try to figure it out, if we try to do it right. And maybe Sesshin is kind of like a boot camp, not for doing it right, but a boot camp for not doing, for non-doing. Maybe in Sesshin we can inhabit a just being in a deep way. There are things to do, apparently. Follow the schedule, do your assigned job. But that's enough, you know, that's more than enough. And there's the teachings, there's the teachings and instructions that are given, and the example of everybody else. But then the great thing about Sesshin is the structure of it. Putting 25, 30 people into one room and living together for days. This requires, calls upon us to be in a certain way, doesn't it? If we were our usual blah, 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 blah kind of way, it would be a disaster, right? We could drive each other nuts in 10 minutes flat. So we have to be a certain way so that we can be together in harmony. So snow is so solid and so heavy, right? So dense, so cold, but water is fluid. Can flow down off the roof and into little cracks. Nothing stops water. If you have a leak in your roof, that's problematic. Like a few of us have had recently. But why don't we not worry about that and be water? Be more like water. See if we can really flow together. Set down our rigidity, our personality, our agenda, our doing it right, our doing it wrong, our rebelling against doing it right, and our rebelling against doing it wrong, our judging other people for doing it right and doing it wrong. It's like endless in there, you know. How do you even cope with your mind for 5 minutes? You know, it's amazing. But you can, because it sloughs off like snow off the roof after a while. Then it freezes up again. The traditional term for novice monks is unsui, which means cloud water. Cloud water. So let's be like clouds and be like water. And Sesshin is a great support for that. And when you try to be something else, the great thing about our system is you will inevitably suffer. It's built in, you know? It's great. It's really good. I don't know how they figured this out. They probably didn't figure it out. It just happened this way. So, Hungjur, our topic this week, is Dogen's great-grandfather in the Dharma. So here's family stories, like rocks on fairies. Hungjur is confusingly transliterated into English as H-O-N-G. That makes sense. Hung, right? H-O-N-G is the first character. Second character is translated Z-H-I, which is pronounced Zhur. Why they figured out that system of transliteration, we don't know. But of course, nobody in China would have written it out in English letters. It's a couple of characters. Which a non-Chinese speaking English Dharma student like me is attempting to pronounce as Hungjur. It's probably something like that. Not exactly, but close. But then the Japanese got a hold of all this and have their own way of pronouncing these same characters. And another layer here, confusion. Every Dharma teacher in our ancestry has multiple names too. Hungjur was his posthumous name given by the emperor, supposedly. It always comes from the emperor, you know. His name that he operated under when he was actively teaching was Tiantong, which actually was the name of the mountain where the monastery was. So he was teaching in, you know, Tiantong. And if that name of that mountain sounds familiar, it should. That's the same mountain and, in fact, the same monastery where Dogen ends up 70 years after Hungjur / Tiantong's death. So where I was going with that is the characters Tiantong, Chinese, are pronounced by the Japanese Tendo. Tendo. So if, like me, you grew up in the tradition of chanting the Japanese voicings of the ancestors, this may sound familiar to you. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. Choryo Seryo Daiosho, Tendo Sogako Daiosho. So Tendo Sogako, that's our guy here. That's Hungjur. So you'll forget all this, so don't worry about it. Some guy before Dogen. Dogen's great-grandfather. I mean, that's easy to remember. So Hungjar didn't write things himself that were that have survived. Dogen did, which is unusual. He wrote a lot, and his original writings survive. Ironically, with Dogen, you know part of why they survived? It's not because people were carefully studying them for the 900 years or whatever, or 900 years since his day. It's because the actual pieces of paper, the scrolls that Dogen wrote on, became treasures to be hidden away and venerated, you know, kept in special cases in the back and brought out once a year, like a saint, you know, like a saint's day. The Dogen stuff, it wasn't even studied that much for hundreds of years. People didn't read it, you know, he just, and is that, and we think, oh, those silly guys, they didn't read it? They weren't that good. Well, that's our bias, right? Maybe it was better for their practice, you know, than our foolish attempts to make sense of this in multiple layers of translation. So Hungjar himself, none of his writings survive, and this is typical of the Chinese Zen masters. The writings that survive are the writings of the people that came later, remembering and recording what they said. So we have is a record document, so kind of a Zen document. And other schools of Buddhism didn't do this quite so much. Zen and the Chinese culture were famous for this. After the master dies, you write down what they said. Maybe you're making a few notes as they go along. Or maybe the stories just get told, someone writes it down hundreds of years later. Very literary culture, but the teacher himself usually wouldn't self-consciously write down what they think and give teachings. So we have a 7-volume record of Hungjar, of which 1.5 volumes have been translated into English that I know of. Maybe there's more scholarly translations. And what we have from this project by a friend of ours, actually, Tigan Dan Leighton, is a little book called Cultivating the Empty Field, which is a great title. Because one of Hungjar's central metaphors in his poetic teachings that don't explain much is an empty field. And there was an empty field coming out of our mouths just this morning. Did you notice that? When we chanted in the early morning before putting on the robe, we chanted something about an empty field. Which turns out to be a bad translation of the Chinese too, so, oh well. I forget what it is literally. It's not exactly an empty field in our robe chant. So layers of translation and understanding and misunderstanding re-understood, you know. It's a great tradition we're in. So one of the things that's written down after the fact is a biography of the master. So I thought in the interest of family stories, I'd read you Taigen's retelling of the traditional biography of this teacher, Hungjar. And scholars don't actually even use the word biography for these. They had to come up with another term because it's probably not exactly what happened, you know. Maybe there's a term, hagiography, means like devotional bibliography. But these are inspiring stories of our ancestors, so we can appreciate them. So I'll abridge a little bit some of the early parts. But here's the essence of this story, and you can read it in Taigen's book, too. So Hungjar was born in the year 1091, by our reckoning, in the town of Xizhou in Shanxi province. And Hungjar, as I mentioned, was a posthumous name, so he wasn't born with that name. That name means vast wisdom. But for convenience, we won't get into as many changes of name. Hungjar, it said, was a very intelligent child. They're always intelligent children. Who memorized thousands of characters before he was 7 years old. His father, Kung Dao, was also a practitioner, a serious lay disciple of a teacher named Daishun. And Daishun, his father's teacher, was really impressed by this kid. and predicted he would become a true vessel of the Dharma. Also typical in these stories. When he was 11 years old, if you have kids, you know, or you know kids, 11 years old. The 11-year-old Hungjir left home and became a monk. And then at 18, he changed to another monastery and really began what we would consider a monastic practice. Probably the 11 and 12-year-olds, it doesn't look quite the same to us as it would then. But starting at 18, he studied with an interesting Soto Zen master named Kumu. Kumu's style of practice was said to involve sitting meditation that was so still, so present, that his body was said to resemble a block of dry wood, or another translation is a stump, tree stump. And so the word Kumu, his name he received or took for himself, means dry wood is the complete Dharma. So there's our advice. Dry wood is the complete Dharma. Just be like a piece of wood, block of wood. And so Hungjir emulated this practice of immobile sitting throughout his career. He was inspired by those trained in this way. Cross-legged sitting in the lotus posture is the fundamental practice and the unstated context of all of Hungjir's meditation instructions. Unstated context. After a few years, Hungjir traveled to other temples. At Xiangshan Temple, and that translates to Incense Mountain Temple. Incense Mountain Temple, that matters, you'll see why. Mm-hmm. Hungjir overheard a monk reciting a line from the Flower Ornament Sutra. The line is, "The eyes which our parents give us can behold 3,000 worlds. The eyes our parents give us can behold 3,000 worlds." Upon hearing this, Hungjir experienced an awakening. Also a usual part of the story. When Hungjir told the master there, so Master Xiangshan, so the same name as the place, of this experience, Xiangshan, the teacher, pointed to a box of incense and said, "What's inside?" Hungjir said, "What does mind do?" Teacher said, "Where does your enlightenment come from?" Hungjir drew a circle in the air. I'm going to do this. Drew a circle in the air with his hands and threw it behind him. It's a famous thing to do. Famous from Hungjir. And the teacher said, "Ah, you are a person who produces mud. What is your true capacity?" Hungjir said, "Mistakes." And the teacher, approved, approved this realization. Taigen comments, such dialogues have their own logic. And effective best with a minimum of explanation. So thank you, Taigen. I appreciate the permission. Hungjir's response to Xiangshan about the incense box reflects his understanding of the interpenetration of everything, mind and phenomena. And later Dogen would echo Hungjir when he called his own life one continuous mistake. So this is nice. It's okay to make mistakes. And he went through various other adventures. And eventually, in the height of his career, was given the abbacy of a Jingde monastery on Mount Tiantog. So this is the monastery that Dogen will come to 90 years later when he arrives. And even though Hungjir was devoted to sitting, simple sitting, he also, like all these masters, loved and treasured and taught the old stories of the other teachers and their ancestors. those stories eventually being gathered by Hongzhi and others into collections of stories and being polished and codified into what we now know of as koans. Koan meaning like a public example, a public case. It's actually a borrowing from legal terminology, like the case on record, you know. I don't know if there's any lawyers here. Yeah, there's a few out there. So even though he's a great luminary in our Soto Zen tradition, famous for poetic teachings, famous for not explaining too much, famous for devotion to just sitting, he actually collected the cases that became one of the famous collections called the Book of Serenity. He put the koans together and made some verses, and the later teacher, after he died, added commentary and kind of put it all together, published it. So this is another, the second fascinating type of Zen literature. The first literature, the first type of literature I mentioned are the discourse records or the sayings records. Here's what the master said. He said this, he said this. Second kind of literature, unique to Zen, are these collections of stories, these koan collections, which are layers and layers. You know, somebody collected it, somebody wrote poems, somebody wrote verse commentary, somebody wrote more. And oftentimes the collaborators in these projects never knew each other and lived over a few hundred years. So we're left with these treasures that are hard for us to make sense of because it's such a different kind of literature than we grew up with. So Hongzhi, when he, this is also typical of these stories, when he arrived at this monastery, the place was a mess. Small and in disrepair. The story says, under Hongzhi's supervision, the temple was reconstructed and eventually accommodated 1,200 monks. Its huge meditation hall could hold all the monks. It's a big hall. Hold all the monks who were drawn to his rich teachings. Hongzhi seems to have been unflappable amidst the difficulties of this expansion. His successor Dogen tells a story of a time when Hongzhi Monastery had provisions for 1,000 monks. It's got to be a lot of rice. But had 1,500 or 1,600 there. An officer of the temple implored Hongzhi to send away the extra monks. There wasn't enough food. But Hongzhi just replied, "Each of them has their own mouth. It is not your concern. Do not worry." And Dogen commends Hongzhi's faith in practice. It's all going to work out. And just to wrap up this abridged story. From his arrival in 1129 to this monastery, Hongzhi remained on Mount Tianthong, refusing all invitations to leave. So he really stayed there for about 30 years, didn't leave the grounds. And then finally, in the autumn of 1157, Hongzhi journeyed down the mountain for the first time in nearly 30 years. He visited local officials and lay patrons of the temple to say goodbye and thank them for their support. He returned to Jingde Temple on November 10th, and the next morning bathed, put on fresh robes, went to the Dharma Hall, and gave a farewell talk to the monks. He asked his attendant for a brush and wrote a letter to his colleague and sometime critic, the Zen teacher Dahui, asking him to take charge of the temple. Then he wrote this verse. Illusory dreams, phantom flowers, 67 years. A white bird vanishes in the mist. Autumn waters merge with the sky. Illusory dreams, phantom flowers, 67 years. A white bird vanishes in the mist. Autumn waters merge with the sky. Then, sitting there in, like a piece of wood in beautiful full lotus, he died. And it's said that they just left him there for a week and he didn't move or, you know, smell or anything. You know? So deep was his meditation. in hearing of this, the emperor wrote, created, you know, picked this name for him. Hongzhir Chanshir, Chan Zen Master of Great Wisdom. So I want to share with you a few of the teachings he left behind. So his teachings, maybe they were delivered as Dharma talks. The style was to give very short talks, usually with the monks standing. Short impressionistic talks. So I want to share a few with you. Of course, the suggestion is not to try too hard to figure this stuff out, but just to let the sensibility and feeling of this, as much as it shines through over the millennia and through translation, wash our hearts and melt our icy bits, help us slough off. Taigen, when he translated these little short talks, created titles, pulling a line out from somewhere in there. So they didn't originally even have titles. And in fact, the old Chinese text usually didn't even have pronunciation. It's just like, you know, scrolls and scrolls of character after character, you know. So we can be really grateful to the translators for sorting this stuff out. Hard work. Let's see, I'll start with this one. This one Taigen called The Cloud's Fascination and the Moon's Cherishing. A person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along in flowing water. The clouds part and mountain appears. The moon sets and the water is cool. Every bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration within bounds. Every dust is whole without reaching me. The 10,000 changes are stilled without shaking me. If you can sit here with stability, then you can freely step across and engage the world with energy. There's an excellent saying that the six sense doors are not veiled. The highways in all directions have no footprints. Always arriving everywhere without being confused, gentle without hesitation, the perfected person knows just where to go. So just seeing, I'll read it again, just seeing if any line or a phrase emerges out of that for you, or not. A person in the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundations. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part. The mountain appears. The moon sets. The water is cool. Every bit of autumn contains vast interconnection without bounds. Every piece of dust is whole without reaching me. The 10,000 changes are stilled without shaking me. If you can sit here with stability, then you can freely step across and engage the world with energy. There is an excellent saying that the six sense doors are not veiled, and the highways in all directions have no footprints. Always arriving everywhere without being confused, gentle without hesitation, the perfected person knows just where to go, just where to go. Let's do one more. This one he called The Bright Boundless Field. So herein is one of the many times he references fields, like farm fields. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, brush away all these tendencies you have fabricated into habits. Then you can simply reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by conditions. Accordingly, we are told to realize that no one thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and respond, unencumbered by each speck of dust, without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors, without leaving traces and mirrors without obscuration. Very naturally, mind and Dharma emerges and harmonizes. An ancient said that non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. Non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. Enacting and fulfilling the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. Proceeding, you are able now to guide the assembly. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. This is how you should penetrate and study. Isn't that great? Like in the way you kind of come, you kind of go into focus and like, what? And then, oh, yeah. Oh, what? Oh, yeah. Because the mind tries to figure this stuff out, right? And nobody is immune to this. We're deeply conditioned. And when Jeff and I set ourselves the intention, the assignment, you know, of saying something about this, then, I don't know, we'll see, we'll hear what Jeff's experience has been. I sat down and went, oh, shit. What have I done? What can you say about this, you know? Nothing. Exactly nothing. And that's what's great about it. That's its value, right? A deep teaching, a deep pointing, a deep kind of feeling that doesn't lend itself so easily to our habit of manipulation, manufacture, grasping, making something into something, and trying to make ourselves into something else. A deep encouragement around this intelligent way of just being. So this isn't like a dumb thing. We're not trying to just dumb it down and forget about our mind, forget about our wisdom, and forget about our intelligence. We want to shine bright in our wisdom and our intelligence, but in a little different way than usual. A way where there's a deep feeling and recognition of our existing, whatever you want to call it. And the minute you put a word on it, we're already sunk. That's why so many of the poems, like in English, they have to put it, you know. You know, what is it? It is this, it's not that, you know. You're like, what is it? What is it? Exactly. Exactly. What is it? What is it? So let's hear this one more time and then I'll stop bothering you with this stuff. Let's see what arises out of this. And sometimes what happens is a phrase strikes you after a while and you can sit with that. Give your grasping, just to kind of throw your grasping mind a rope there, you know. There'll be something good in there we can grasp onto. Don't worry, you know. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. But you must purify, cure, grind down, brush away all these tendencies you've fabricated into habits. Then you can reside, just reside in the clear circle of brightness, utter emptiness with no image, upright independent that does not independence that does not rely on anything. Expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by conditions. Accordingly, we are told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field of birth and death, in this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and respond, unencumbered by every speck of dust, without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends colors and sounds, and the whole affair functions without leaving traces, mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. An ancient said, non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. enacting and fulfilling the way of non-mind. Finally, you can rest. Proceeding, you're able to guide the assembly. With thoughts clear, silently sitting, wander into the center of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. So those last four, three or four sentences, you could kind of, there's kind of a narrative there maybe, huh? Natural. He says this is natural. And if it's the non-mind, is it something we do? Is it something we can be? Is it something that just happens? And of course, Dogen's big question was, well, how, why is this, what, you know? If it's this way, if it's really this way, why do we practice? Why do we need to practice? He cites a koan in one of his texts that we chant that talks, he uses wind as a metaphor for enlightenment. There's wind everywhere. And yet the ancient in that story says, well, you still need to wave your fan. You still need to practice. Even though wind is everywhere, even though the non-mind is realizing the non-mind, we still need to show up and sit like a block of wood, waiting patiently, you know, for the snow to melt. And patient, all the more when it freezes again. Because we don't get to control the seasons. Although it seems we have, as a collective, done a number on the climate anyway, but... But here we are on a bright winter day, another year gone by, trying to remember Buddha. Let's just continue. Thank you.